earlier and had it raised interest rates well before it started raising them and raised them more substantially, we probably wouldn't be headed to even higher rates down the road, and certainly inflation would have been brought back under control.
The rate rise will have consequences, economists say, for other sectors of the economy, such as the housing market, where 2.5 million Britons will soon have to renew their home loans at higher interest rates. For months, increases in wholesale energy prices caused by self-imposed sanctions over the war in Ukraine were blamed for the unbridled inflation here. Energy prices have since eased, but inflation hasn't.
Well, what did Rishi Sunak do when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer? He borrowed well over £300 billion, increasing the fiscal deficit to 15% of GDP. How was that financed? It wasn't financed through tax rises. It wasn't financed through some sort of government cuts or anything like that. It was financed purely by printing of money by the Bank of England. £300 billion in one go, raising the UK money supply from £600 billion to £900 billion in the space of 1 year.
Rampant inflation has seen grocery prices shoot up by up to 20%. The demand for food banks doubled compared to 5 years ago, and months of public sector strikes for pay rises.
This is the 12th consecutive interest rate rise in less than 2 years, with the Bank of England leaving the door open for more hikes in the coming months. The question now is, when will the bank hit the pause button? Syed Pourreza, London.
Hundreds of people attended a memorial service for slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. Abu Akleh held an American passport and worked for the Al Jazeera TV network. She was killed by an Israeli sniper on May 11, 2022, while she was covering an Israeli raid in the West Bank city of Jenin. Footage captured moments after she was shot shows her motionless body with another Palestinian reporter being seen next to her. Both are wearing easily recognizable press vests and blue helmets. Since her killing, Abu Akleh has been hugely remembered by Palestinians for her dynamism and courage to cover Israeli crimes. The road where her office was located is now named Shireen Abu Akleh Street.
Every morning we pass by her office to say good morning, Shireen. All our colleagues, including myself, who accompanied her when she was martyred, still think that she is on vacation and will be back to the office.
Shortly after her death, the U.S. government said evidence showed Abu Akleh was killed by an Israeli bullet. But ironically, Washington claimed that it had seen no evidence pointing to her killing being intentional, a line that has also been used by the Israeli regime. Washington also promised an investigation to find out the truth, but a year of U.S. inaction has prompted Palestinians to take the matter into their own hands.
The case has been submitted to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We're still working to pressure on the Attorney General and the court itself to act and to take a stand in this regard, either by announcing the creation of an official independent international investigation committee or by simply announcing his position.
Abu Akleh was not the first journalist to be killed by the Israeli regime. A report by the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate published in 2023 shows Israel has murdered more than 50 Palestinian journalists in the past 22 years, but the regime has never taken responsibility for any of those killings. Many fear that Israel's impunity only means more Palestinian journalists will be killed in the future.
Israel wants to silence the free speech and the voice of the press, as well as the truth which convey the atrociousness of the Israeli occupation and its crimes.
Even Western politicians who are staunch supporters of Israel are now calling for an independent and thorough probe into the Palestinian journalist's murder. But after so many calls and too many letdowns, many are now questioning whether the situation would have been different if Abu Akleh had not been Arab or Palestinian.
Pakistan. Pakistan's Supreme Court has ruled that the arrest of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan was illegal, ordering his immediate release and asking the government to ensure his security. The court also urged the ex-premier to condemn the violent protests and emphasized that court's primary responsibility is to protect the citizens of the country. The country's top judge in his short verdict said that Khan would be kept in the police headquarters till his next appearance before the High Court on Friday over safety concerns. Khan was arrested by Pakistan's security forces on Tuesday over corruption allegations. The ruling Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz has criticized the country's Supreme Court for setting Imran Khan free, calling him a criminal.
The Supreme Court has double standards toward the government and Imran Khan. It has ruled that Khan, who is accused of corruption, should be provided with all facilities and be able to meet people freely. It would send a message that the courts are willing to compromise on justice. My only question is why the court has double standard.
The angry supporters of Imran Khan welcomed the Supreme Court decision, saying the release of their leader actually upholds the rule of law in the country.
Supreme Court of Pakistan ka shukr ada.
We are thankful to the Supreme Court for releasing Imran Khan from illegal detention by the government. The recent verdict of the top court will be considered as the supremacy of the rule of law in the country, which was violated by the current regime.
After being released by the court, the former PM expressed his grievances about his arrest, stating that he was abducted illegally and tortured during custody. Khan urged followers of his party to end their protests and refrain from damaging public and private property. Pakistan remains in the grip of deadly violence and protests after the arrest of the ex-premier.
Although the former Pakistani premier can now breathe a sigh of relief following the top court's decision, experts believe that Imran Khan has to prepare himself for more political challenges in coming days. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The fourth Tehran International Book Fair has opened in the Iranian capital. Some 2,700 domestic publishers and 100 foreign publishers from over 40 countries have attended this fair this year. The motto of this year's book fair is "The future is worth reading." The international section of the fair aims to introduce the capacities of the publishing industry of the Islamic Republic of Iran to expand cultural exchanges in the international scene to lay the groundwork for communication between Iranian and foreign publishers. For the first time, bookstore owners can participate in the exhibition, and 200 have registered to compete with publishers in the virtual exhibition.
As you know, that Tehran Book Fair, one of the most important book fairs, that's Oman, Sultanate of Oman, that's need, that should be that participate. You know, as you know, that's more that's visit to the book fair. And as you know, that's one of the most important, that's to participate. The relationship between Oman and Iran, that's most important and large. So that's from many years, that's about the relations.
For the second time, a virtual exhibition has also been launched to make books available to book enthusiasts. As usual, the books are available to the public at a discount. The rate of discount is 10% for the virtual exhibition and can be as high as 20% if you visit the fair in person.
The Tehran Book Fair provides a good opportunity for international visitors, book lovers, publishers, distributors and retailers to meet and do business and at the same time exchange culture during the 10-day event. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria and Turkey agreed to prepare a roadmap for developing relations between Damascus and Ankara. Relations between Ankara and Damascus soured after the foreign-backed militancy broke out in Syria in 2011, when flows of Syrian refugees flooded Turkey. The safe and dignified return of Syrian refugees was one of the key principles for the Moscow talks.
It has been a key principle for all the countries present here to contribute to a safe and voluntary return of refugees and internally displaced persons to the places of the permanent residence in Syria, as well as to ensure their right to receive support It appears important to start discussing the issue of restoring disrupted transport and logistics ties between neighboring countries and resuming trade and economic cooperation without any barriers.
The participants also discussed the U.S. measures in creating a so-called Free Syrian Army, which used ISIS militants and other terrorist organizations against Syria's legitimate authorities with the aim of destabilizing the situation in the country. Russian and Syrian militaries have recently discussed the issue, agreeing on a model of joint action in that regard. The sides also discussed the legitimate unilateral sanctions applied by the U.S. and its Western allies, which block the provision of international humanitarian assistance to Syria, including through the U.N. The head of the Russian Foreign Ministry drew attention to the fact that the U.N. humanitarian plan for the current year for Syria was funded by 8%, but the emergency appeal of the same U.N. to provide assistance in the territories not controlled by Damascus was immediately paid almost in full.
The talks in Moscow can be called historic. Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria and made great efforts to ensure that this meeting took place. Moscow has demonstrated that its conditions are realistic. It was supported by Iran in this, which has done a lot to save the sovereignty of Syria. The meeting of the Syrian minister and his Turkish counterpart gives hope for the establishment of calm in the country. Turkey had to come to terms with the fact that Bashar al-Assad's power will remain. We have witnessed a reset in relations and what the collective West has been trying to prevent in every possible way.
The process of normalizing relations between Ankara and Damascus was launched on December 28, 2022 in Moscow, when first consultations were held between the heads of the defense ministries of Russia, Syria and Turkey. Earlier, President Erdogan invited President Putin to hold a trilateral meeting with the participation of the Syrian leader. This summit, according to him, should have been preceded by negotiations at the level of representatives of the special services, defense and foreign ministers.
The foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Turkey and Syria warned that their countries will not allow any external interference in regional affairs. They expressed readiness to boost their fight against terrorism, saying they will be in full swing to ensure security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
EU leaders are accused of failing the people of Sudan. The 27-nation bloc's weak foreign policy in Africa has allowed tensions to develop into chaos and carnage, according to some legislators in the European Parliament.
We must understand that hoping for the best is not sufficient. If we do not engage constructively and in a timely, effective manner, we will always need to run for cover when it is already too late.
It's the Rapid Support Forces versus the Sudanese Armed Forces. Rival generals, once allies, are battling it out.
The West were happy to legitimize a de facto military dictatorship because this is the arrangement that has served our financial interests and the interests of the IMF and the World Bank for many years.
In the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. The situation in Darfur and other regions is also dire. When it comes to African nations, the West is accused by critics of only ever having been interested in pillaging natural resources, such as gold, diamonds and oil. At least 450,000 people have been forced to flee their homes in Sudan since war broke out on April 15th.
Let us not allow for a new tragedy, or at least do the utmost of our efforts. If the EU wants to live up to its values, this is the time to go for our limits.
Foreign powers are competing for influence in Sudan because of its position on the map. Apparently, the EU has taken its eye off the ball.
Don't make the mistake to only focus on the war in Ukraine. All kinds of leaders seize the opportunity because they see the European Union as a soft power entity.
The EU has opened its doors to millions of Ukrainian refugees. The bloc is being criticized for not providing safe routes for those escaping Sudan.
I hope that this will be a matter for the meeting of the Foreign Affairs Council, which takes place this weekend. It's currently not on the agenda, and I would urge the Commission to try to address this.
Some commentators claim Washington is pouncing on the crisis with an aim of implementing ideological changes by removing Islam from Sudan's constitution. Once again, the US is accused of interference to try and further its own agenda. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Oh.
On May 9th, Russia commemorates the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union and the 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians killed in the World War II, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War. This year, the victory parade on Red Square in the heart of Russian capital Moscow was held without the usual aerial maneuvers and with a minimum of equipment. With the latest military developments in the Ukraine war, fighter jets, tanks and missile defense systems were partly showed, as they are needed today at the front line. In his Victory Day speech, President Vladimir Putin said that the real war is once again unleashed against Russia, but the country will ensure its security and protect the inhabitants of Donbas.
Boundless ambition, arrogance and impunity inevitably lead to tragedies. This is the reason for the catastrophe the Ukrainian people are going through. They have become hostage to the coup d'etat and the resulting criminal regime of its Western masters, collateral damage in the implementation of the cruel and self-serving plans.
Vladimir Putin also criticized the demolition of monuments to Soviet soldiers and said the West is creating a Nazi cult. The president pointed out that the desecration of a generation of victors is a crime.
It is a crime, an outright revanchism on the part of those who were cynically and blatantly preparing a new march on Russia and who brought together neo-Nazis come from around the world for this. Their goal, and there is nothing new about it, is to break apart and destroy our country, to make null and void the outcomes of World War II, to completely break down the system of global security and international law, to chalk off any sovereign centers of development.
At 14, I became a partisan, then an infantryman, machine gunner. This is our victory, and we have won this memory. We see the depressing example of Europe. I want to say that Russians will never forget this day and will always remember it. Here, it will always be honored.
I'm from Makeyevka, from Donbas. My entire mining family has perished since 2014. Only one son remained. And today, I've come here in Moscow to pay my debt to all the defenders, the soldiers of our past and present.
Unlike last year, the Russian president did not announce new measures to support the participants in the special military operation, but noted the leaders of the CIS countries who came to celebrate Victory Day in Moscow. Together with Putin, the leaders of Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan watched the parade on Red Square.
For millions of Russians, May the 9th is a lot more than a national celebration. Today, Russians celebrate their victory over the Nazis in 1945. The Russians are one of the last who celebrate this holiday officially, remember which side were the heroes, and at what cost the Soviets got this victory. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when he authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Athwaye. Palestinian resistance groups and Israel have agreed on a ceasefire. Palestinian factions say the ceasefire has been brokered by Cairo. The agreement follows 5 days of the Israeli onslaught and bombing campaign on the besieged Gaza Strip and retaliatory rocket attacks from resistance fighters hitting Israeli settlements. characteristic of Israeli bombing campaign, there is a disproportionate use of force that was reflected in the death toll. 33 Palestinians were killed, many of them women and children. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how Israel has failed when it comes to not achieving its desired outcomes. Joining us for this program is Mukhaibar Abu Sada. He's a professor of political science at Al-Azhar University. And we also have Zakir Ahmad Mayed, who's an attorney, activist, and political analyst, joining us from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Mukhaibar Abu Sada, let's first start with you. There's a ceasefire that was agreed upon by both sides, it appears, where Egypt was the mediator. It actually is supposed to start right when our program started. We have to wait and see whether that's going to actually hold or not. But what's interesting about the ceasefire is that you had Israel saying that just hours before, maybe in the morning time, where you had Israel that said, we are not interested in a ceasefire. It even claimed that the Islamic Jihad had thousands of rockets and we need to continue with this operation. Why do you think then it would agree to a ceasefire if it knows that there's a finite number of rockets that the Islamic Jihad has, might as well have gone ahead and finished the job?
It's true, as you just indicated, a ceasefire will be in place in about half an hour from now, 10 p.m. Gaza time, Jerusalem time, which would mean the formula for this ceasefire agreement is that both sides, the Palestinian resistance groups and the Israeli occupation, will not target civilians and civilian infrastructure, including Palestinian civilian homes. That is the formula that has been accepted by both sides just about an hour ago. It's true, as you just indicated, up until this evening, Israel was not acceptable of the ceasefire formula that was presented by the Egyptian mediators yesterday, which asked Israel, upon the request of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, that Israel put an end to its assassination policy, which has in which Israel has used many times, and it has used 5 days ago when it assassinated three top members of the military wing of the Islamic Jihad. Therefore, we are witnessing a new formula that has been accepted by both sides. But let me also add one more point before I finish. After 5 days of fighting between Palestinian resistance groups and the Israeli occupation, 33 Palestinians have been killed. More than of them are Palestinian civilians, including six children, four women, and other Palestinian civilians. In the meantime, the Palestinian resistance groups, mainly Palestinian Islamic Jihad, have fired more than 1,000 rockets against Israeli towns and villages, and most of these rockets were fell inside the territory of the Israeli occupation. It's been painful for Israel. Israel thought that it will be a very limited and very speedy operation. Israel did not think that this operation will last for 5 days, which has been criticized by the Israeli public, Israeli opposition, who thought that Israel has paid a very heavy price, especially financial price over the past 5 days.
All right, Zakir Ahmed, over to you. Here you have a ceasefire that's been announced. And when you take a look at the operation I don't want to say who won and who lost, because it can't really be put in those plain terms. I mean, after all, there were 33 Palestinians that were killed. But when you take a look at the purpose that Israel was after, what did it really achieve? Yes, it did assassinate some of the Islamic Jihad leaders, but is that going to safeguard itself from further acts coming from the resistance groups? Because I'm sure you agree Israel's not going to stop what it's been doing in the occupied territories, i.e. raids that have led to Palestinian deaths, which this year is on record with the most number of deaths.
No, not at all. I think Israel's strategic and policy decision was to create a kinetic operation within Gaza, spurred on by the, and I would go with this word, assassination of Shahad Aratnan, the key figure within Islamic Jihad. It definitely created the situation. They started striking Gaza as well, and naturally there's going to be a response by the resistance. Israel's approach, and there's an interesting article that just came out a few days ago with regards to the Israeli policy on this particular operation. Amir Rappaport was the author, and he has written for the Begin Sadat Center, and also was the editor of Israel Defense at one stage. And he said that this is a typical attempt by Israel to establish deterrence capacity, namely create a short kinetic operation, come to a ceasefire. And we've seen this repetitive pattern over the years. We saw it in 2012 with the assassination of one of the Hamas commanders, Ahmed Jabari. There was an Operation Pillar of Defense. We have ceasefires. We have the same thing in 2014, Operation Protective Edge, ceasefire. We see the same thing now. I think one key aspect that changed this, and there was a very key point that you raised with my other fellow panelists, is what changed between this morning and now on the Israeli side to spur on this particular ceasefire. And that is the entrance of Izzeddin al-Qassam, the Hamas movement, into the field with heavier weapons. There was a report of an 80GM anti-tank guided missile strike on a group of Israeli soldiers. Casualties were now being seen. And this changes the framework. Israel wanted to keep it a small operation so that they can make the public see it as a successful operation. However, when it goes into a larger regional conflict with the entrance of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, and many of the other groupings of Al-Muqawwam al-Islamiyya, this becomes a clear defeat and loss for Israel. So therefore, we have to understand it within the context. It's not going to stop Israel, but I do believe Al-Muqawwam al-Islamiyya is looking at the flag march for a larger escalation. I believe that is the assessment of the situation on the ground right now.
Mukhabar Abu Sadr, you talked about the rockets and how that was one of the achievements made by the Islamic Jihad and the resistance groups as a whole. Basically, over 1,000 rockets, as you said, made it, 1,100 rockets have been fired from Gaza, 300 intercepted by the air defenses. So let's see, you got 800 that actually then made it. Now, in terms of the areas that it hit, it seemed like the number of areas in terms of towns, Israeli towns and cities, was increasing, and the targets were becoming more effective. But you have the success rate be a minimum 30% or higher, which even two rockets could achieve the goals. But what does that say about the way that Israel looks when you have that happening, and a so-called missile dome system or Iron Dome missile shield defense system that is unable to really intercept the rockets? And it is also said that if all the resistance groups from the Gaza Strip were to fire all the rockets all at once, that would inundate Israel and it would create huge damage.
That is definitely a very important issue here. As you just indicated at the end of your question, it was only the Palestinian Islamic Jihad who have been fighting Israel for the past 5 days. Yes, the fighting was under the name of the Joint Operations Room, which include other Palestinian groups, but mainly Israel has been targeted, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the rockets that were fired from Gaza against Israel was very much done by PIJ, even though it came under the name of the Joint Operations Room. Now, even according to Israeli statistics, shooting of more than 1,000 rockets, and some of these rockets reach Tel Aviv area, which is 80 kilometers from Gaza, and another rocket reached the surrounding of Jerusalem, which is almost 100 kilometers from Gaza. That has been a tipping point for the PIJ, that it has done so. And as you very much know, that one Israeli was killed in the missile that hit the Israeli city of Rehoboth 2 days ago, and the injury of 9 other Israelis. But the most important issue here is that the miscalculation of Israel. Israel felt that by killing and assassinating the 3 top members of the military wing of PIJ, it thought that that will paralyze PIJ and it will not be able to retaliate. But that was completely not true. PIJ was able to regroup itself, was able to retaliate, and was able to stay steadfastness in spite of Israeli retaliation and Israeli aggression over the past 5 days.
All right, let's take do a history check over here. I think you kind of went into that, Zakir, in terms of what you mentioned. Let me just make sure I have my stats straight here. We're looking at 15 military operations that Israel has carried out in the Gaza Strip since the year 2005. And the basic question that comes out of these military operations is, what are these campaigns achieving? I mean, what are they doing? We know, of course, how many Palestinians have been killed. But, when you take a look at the goals and objectives, it seems like Israel has to exercise and execute these bombing campaigns or military escapades, if you want to call them, or incursions. But what are they really achieving if it has to get repeated?
Just before I answer your question, I just got a notification now that Tel Aviv is being targeted as we speak. Sirens are going off in Tel Aviv, so we can see that the resistance is as strong as it was when it began. As you go to the question that you've just raised now, what is the purpose and what is the policy objective behind this? The policy objective has always been to try and maintain Israel's deterrence capacity. In simple words, it's the fear of Israel that Israel will go completely insane if you engage in a military confrontation with it. It's exactly what they tried to do in 2006 with Lebanon, with the Tahiya principle developed by Major General Giora Island and a few of the other military establishment officials. And this is the aim of this, to try and scare the population that surrounds them into fearing Israel's retaliation. And also, this is to create a perception that Israel is capable, it's a fighting force, and it can unite its people. Particularly now, this is important, when Israel is so fractured at a domestic level, they needed a rallying point. And war serves as a sure crowd pleaser for the Israeli society. Nothing unites the Israeli society more than the bloodletting of the Palestinians. So this was key for Israel to engage in it now, as it has always been. You've pointed out a very clear pattern, and it's correctly placed, that this is a policy decision of Israel. However, what has changed in the last few years is that Israel's space of maneuvering has surely narrowed. What you have now is a new equation that has developed due to the unification of the fronts, that any transgressions will be answered not in one arena. When you listen to Israeli military assessments, it always separates Gaza from the West Bank. It always separates Gaza, West Bank from East Jerusalem, and Al-Quds. It separates it from the arena of Lebanon. And these are the frameworks in which Israel operates. However, now it's very different. The transgression in one arena equals a transgression in all. And what you have is now grades of escalation that are taking place. You'll have an engagement in Gaza. It will deplete Israel's capabilities and then move on. Just a point on the missile interceptors that you had raised with my fellow panelists. The Iron Dome has been hacked multiple times during this operation. In fact, just before we came on air, the Iron Dome had been hacked in Sidroth and around Ashkelon, and they had no capability to intercept. That is why you're having such a poor interception rate, number one, and you've already spent $74 million USD just on Tamir interceptor missiles. It's an insane amount, and you have not much to produce for it. There's massive damage on the Israeli side. The society has been in bunkers, and as I've just mentioned already, Tel Aviv is being attacked as we speak.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about this, I'm curious, Khabir Abbasada, as to why Israel continues with its bombing campaigns on the Gaza Strip every so often and in intervals. Perhaps I should quote the Hezbollah Secretary General, who has said, Netanyahu, and I'm quoting him, cannot lie to Israeli society by saying that he has restored deterrence as the resistance in Gaza stands strong, and it has thwarted the enemy's goal of restoring deterrence. I mean, that is definitely true, especially if we want to take a look at this truce, which is announced after 5 days. Do you see that as a withdrawal of Israel's military might to the point where it can't go on with a massive military and bombing campaign, given what we just have witnessed, if it holds again this truce that has been reached between Israel and the Islamic Jihad?
Well, let me answer the first part of your question. There is no dispute about the fact that Netanyahu decided to go on with this operation for his own internal and personal agenda. We all know that Netanyahu was viewed as a very weak leader in Israel, and Israel has been facing a very deep split between so-called liberals and right-wing and religious political parties for the past 5 months since the start of this government. Israeli leftists and center-leftists have been protesting almost every Saturday since the beginning of this year, protesting against Netanyahu and his coalition. And it was an excuse for Netanyahu to go with this operation to kill the top military commanders of the PIJ to try to show to unite the Israeli public behind him. That's one thing. And second, Israeli so-called Israeli deterrence has been weakened lately by rockets being fired from Gaza, and also rockets were fired from South Lebanon about a month and a half ago. And the inability of Israel to fight back or to retaliate, that's one thing. And also the courage of the Palestinian resistance and Lebanese resistance to launch rockets against Israel led to the so-called of weakening of Israeli deterrence. And Netanyahu has been repeating and saying that the goal of this operation is to get Israeli deterrence or restructure Israeli deterrence in the face of Palestinian resistance and other groups. But look, I can tell you that this is just a big joke. There isn't anything called Israeli deterrence. The resilience of Palestinian resistance and its ability and capability to keep shooting rockets up until this moment, as we are speaking right now, that sirens went off in the surroundings of Tel Aviv area, Holon, Rishon LeZion, and other areas, and also in the enclave of Gaza, where Palestinian resistance groups are shooting rockets up until this moment. That means there is nothing called Israeli deterrence. If Israeli deterrence has succeeded, that could have deterred the Palestinians from shooting rockets anymore. But that is just to make Netanyahu look bad in the eyes of the Israelis, and that the goal of this operation was a failure from day one.
I'm sure you're going to have many analysts come out and maybe they have already and reached that conclusion. But Zahir, taking a look at what I think this is what maybe is the key here, the statement that the Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Yoav Gallant, said. He said that the likelihood of a major escalation in one arena would most likely quickly spread into multi-front war. Our guest there, Mukhabab Asada, talked about how you know, there's been rocket fire coming from the Gaza Strip, coming from southern Lebanon. You may see it come from Syria. You may see it come from different fronts. And maybe that is why Israel perhaps maybe agreed to a truce. This Yoav Gallant also said this is the end of the era of limited conflicts. What do you think about the stance as revealed through this Israeli Minister for Military Affairs?
Sure. No. Allahu Akbar. May the resistance be successful. The way we look at it is this is a united battle. There's grades of escalation. This is a means of depleting Israel's capability to defend itself. The next phase of the battle will come. I believe one of the tipping points and flashpoints is going to be the march, the flag march that will take place on the 18th. The resistance is fully on board. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has mentioned it as well. And this is very clear. All the statements have indicated this, and the meeting in Damascus before this with all the factions, including Iraqi factions, have indicated that we are united, I believe, in the victory of al-Muqawama.
Thank you so much. We're going to end it there. We're fresh out of time. Zakir Ahmed Mayet, attorney, activist, and political analyst. Khabir Abusada, thank you so much. Professor of Political Science at Al-Azhar University. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Experts say indicators point to an impending economic downturn in the United States of America. Strategists warn that the U.S. recession is looming. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the U.S. is on the brink of recession, judging from its brutally bad economic data. Chris Watling, chief executive of financial advisory from Longview Economics, said in an interview with CNBC recently. According to the strategist, one of the factors pointing to a looming recession is the latest reading of the leading economic index for the U.S., which fell by 1.2% in March, its lowest level since November 2020. Furthermore, the standard timeline for a recession is about 1 year after the inversion of the Treasury yield curve, when yields on shorter-dated securities rise above those for longer-term ones. As the curve first inverted in March 2022, the economic downturn may well be just around the corner, Vasling said. He was cited as saying, "Every time you've had that in the U.S., you've had a recession. So I think it's coming. It's on the way. It's just a timing issue." Just last month, the inversion intensified, reaching negative 103.1 basis points, which represented the largest gap between shorter-dated and longer-term yields since September 1981, when the American economy was in the early month of a recession. Vatling also warned of the consequences for equity markets once recession hits. He explained, "They won't come through it unscathed, in our opinion. It's not even sure about relativity. The reality is, if you look at profit margins, they went to record highs in 2021 and a bit of 2022. And of course, when you have a lot of inflation around, you can get very good operating leverage, so you can get record high profit margins. When you get into recession, we've got to do a double hit on profit margins. You've got to normalize them back to normal levels, and then you've got to price in a recession." According to Vatling, expectations for earnings are currently way too optimistic given the direction the economy is going. A major financial crash will likely hit by mid-June, Harry Dent, economist and author of several best-selling books, told the David Lynn Report recently. Dent, who has a history of making controversial predictions, believes that the current market bubble will burst and result in a financial meltdown. The bubble is a result of the U.S. Federal Reserve's loose monetary policy, which has artificially inflated the stock market, according to Dent. He expects the S&P 500 to collapse by 86% in this crash, and the Nasdaq to plummet by 92%. The crypto market will go into a tailspin alongside the stocks, the economist warned, predicting that Bitcoin will tumble 95 to 96% from its November 2021 high. Bitcoin will fall from $69,000 to about $3,000 to $4,000, he said, adding that it's exactly that Amazon and the dot-coms did. Dent points to what he sees as overlapping crises as the reason for his pessimism. The pandemic shattered the global economy in many ways, leading to job losses and reducing consumer spending. Additionally, unprecedented inflation in most wealthy countries and supply chain disruptions have sparked serious concerns among investors and economists, forcing them to realize that this is not a big correction. It is a major crash, one that you have not seen in your lifetime, and the one that even the millennials will not see a bigger crash than this, Dent added. According to The Economist, despite efforts by central banks and their declared war on recession, we keep falling back into the recession because the economy underneath, is really weak and really needs to get rid of a lot of really bad debt and zombie companies, and the central banks won't let the economy do its thing. Dent cautioned about the third wave of the crisis coming, emphasizing that, in his view, it's going to creep up on the Federal Reserve before they can reverse the tightening. We have not cleaned up the massive debts and overvaluations of the biggest financial assets bubble in everything. We have never had a financial asset bubble in everything like this. This bubble has not been allowed to burst and clear out its excesses, which we need to do. And I think we are into that process now, Dent concluded. The economist expects a crash more like 1929 to 1932, referring to the Great Depression, stressing that this is his best forecast at this time.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.